Hello, friends, and good morning here from Finland. Today is the 10th of July. What year is it, after all? 2013. And this is the second part of the book, probably the most important part of esoteric astrology, and maybe, I think, reasonably, the most difficult to understand. It will take us forward another 200 and some 70-some pages, something like that. I began this project in 2011 on March 23rd with Leo rising. Maybe I can find that. Okay, coming up, there it is. That is the chart from Phoenix, Arizona, just before our conference work there. And as you see, this is the this is the prevailing chart. The Sun and Uranus are conjunct, and the part of fortune is there as well, and it's all in the ninth house of higher mind, which is, I think, of great value when doing something of this nature. And Jupiter's there and Mercury is there, so hopefully new thoughts will be emerging in the entire project. And there is a grand trine here between the ascendant, which expresses the symbol, the constellations in the night sky. I think a very appropriate symbol. And the very first degree of Sagittarius for the moon, and then all of these planets completing the grand trine. So it's rolling along. It takes a little while to find time to do these. I'd like to be doing them all the time, but there are so many other responsibilities. I'm actually beginning with a very different kind of chart right now. And it is a secondary chart. It has Virgo rising. It's a sign which for me is now important, being the progressed ascending sign. And it emphasizes more, well, of course, again, the ninth house is emphasized through the presence of Uranus there. And whenever there is new thought emerging, that is important. The same Saturn is found in the third house, hopefully contributing to exactitude of thought. See, Saturn is in the third here, in the original chart and the prevailing chart. And Saturn is also in the third. I like to keep it there because it makes one concentrate one's thinking principle. Here the emphasis is more upon the 11th house and the subjective 12th house. We're going to be getting into some deeper matters, still deeper. As you know how I try to do these, I don't really plan them so much. I'm relying upon years of study of esoteric astrology. It's just a drop in the bucket, of course. And what is required is to extrapolate upon what is seen and make links and correlations which can stimulate the thought of those who may have the patience to listen to all this. You know, our production methods here, we're not exactly in a sound studio. I'm all by myself with two computers. I'm trying to stay on some sort of program which allows me to continue capturing my screen and sending you the results. The Sun has moved into a degree that's not it. Thank goodness that's not it. It's a Cancerian degree, and it's 18-something. Let's take a look. A priest performing a marriage ceremony. Well, what I hope is the result of this is the union of soul and personality, creating an illumined mind which can fathom some of these deeper factors of astrology, deeper, wider, higher factors. The Mercury is retrograde, and of course, it says a hen scratching for her chicks, and I sometimes feel like I'm the hen, you know. What I'm trying to do is to dig up some sustenance in the field of thought for those who wish to follow this understanding, a deeper understanding of astrology. As I say, it's just scratching, literally scratching the surface, just like the hen does. And it is, in one sense, the ruler of the chart. It's the orthodox ruler. It is a Mercury retrograde, so there may be some problem in communicating. I had managed to have a little frog in my throat when I started. But I hope that will go away before long. And then the esoteric ruler is the moon. And it is in the 12th house. It's in the sign Leo. And let's see here. Sometimes this program gets a little stubborn and you have to go through a number of steps to make it emerge. But early morning dew, I like that. It contains special powers, and perhaps there is some elixir in these thoughts, which will be a special stimulant to the intuitive mind working at the apprehension of the new astrology. That, you know, it's going to emerge in a group manner. There are a number of people that I know that are working on, and I just know a few, you know, who are working in esoteric astrology, and there are many more because the Tibetan's books are far more widely spread than we can imagine. But, you know, my colleagues Nicholas Nilan and Stephen Pugh and Philip Lindsay, and my colleague Keith Bailey, who is into all these things, and my colleague Elena Dramcini, and Malvin Artley, and, you know, many people all over the world, well, maybe just a few, and all the people that we have at our University of the Seven Rays Esoteric Astrology pre-conference, Kathy Newburn and Jan Dietrich. I don't like to leave anybody out. I try to be inclusive here. Lawson Bracewell, of course, from New Zealand, deeply involved in these matters. So a group is bringing in the new astrology. Peter Kubaska, David Walters. You know, I know personality names mean nothing really, but it's the qualities that they all represented. My own daughter, Heidi Robbins, a wonderful astrologer in this field, working on the psychological and inspirational angle of esoteric astrology. I've been very happy, pleased to work with such a fine group of astrologers who seek to bring the new astrology forward. And lately added to it B.L. Allison and Francis Donald, artist and astrologer. So it's going to be a group presentation, really. It takes a group to try to fathom what is new here. And DK knows we can't fathom it all. He gives us hints that probably will only be expounded upon with accuracy in centuries ahead. And how wonderful that he will be coming out from 2025 onward with the third installment of his teaching, which will include esoteric astrology. That's what he specifically mentions. And it will become, as it was before, the science of all sciences, the greatest and the oldest of all the sciences. And will help us make sense out of our lives so we can truly see what we are doing and enjoy the process, which these days may be a little difficult. There are so many stresses in the world, but we try to understand the stresses. And one of my astrological friends who's really wonderful at that is David Keston. He has a marvelous grasp of all the so many branches of astrology. I don't really want to leave anybody out, you know. But, you know, doing this spontaneously, I may forget people who really are contributing to the field, people that I know. And I know there are others out there who have written books on the subject that I have not read. I'm trying not to read too many books. When I wrote my Infinitization of Selfhood, which was more philosophical approach to the subject of being or beingness, I tried not to read any books. I'd been well schooled in the Tibetan's books, but I dropped that particular form of language and tried to devise my own for it. It was written at a time, I think, when the progress moon was in Capricorn. So yeah, I was trying to see the great big picture here. And when coming to the astrology book, I'd like to get it straight from the Tibetan, and I think it's the wisest thing. We all have our ideas, many, many excellent ideas of interpretation. As I have studied the decanates here, I've drawn upon material that has been brought forward by two excellent decanatists that make up a word, Nicholas Nilan and Stephen Pugh, both excellent thinkers in the astrological field. And I've used many charts which have been created and expanded by Keith Bailey and the AUM, Ancient Universal Mysteries Organization, for which I'm very grateful. I'm also a member there. And pleased that he has drawn these charts together and made them available for the use of serious esotericists. So we're grateful for that contribution. There's so many contributions here from people who are going to make this a true group presentation. But as I say, we're scratching the surface. The hen is scratching for food here, for our sustenance. I haven't looked at all of these degrees. I see here a kind of a six-pointed star, maybe you see it too, which is the symbol of the monad, a symbol also of the Deva kingdom. And Virgo, interestingly enough, a sign much associated with the Deva kingdom. The six and the 12 are Devic numbers, and the Seal of Solomon, as it's called, is far more than the so-called Jewish star. It's far more ancient. It reveals great astrological relationships and the great Akbar, an incarnation of the Master Maurya, used it as his symbol. When I was in Agra, India, I saw it on his the buildings in his compound. So there's, there's the Seal of Solomon actually does exist between various points. This is the degree that that's not it. It's not showing me exactly what I want to see. I have to find it in my own way. Sometimes I would have to stop the whole program and reboot esoteric astrology. I don't want to do that. Boy, this may be the picture of me. The midheaven here, it says, an old man attempting vainly to reveal the mysteries. Well, maybe I'm in that boat here, and I hope it's not too vain or in vain, and I hope I can somewhat come up with some thoughts which will lead us all in fruitful directions. This is, as I say, a secondary chart, but hopefully we'll be able to get that flash of inspiration that comes from Uranus in the ninth house. And let's see. what that degree might be. I'm taking the roundabout method here because it's a book which a bomb which failed to explode is now safely concealed. Well, there's some energy there, that's for sure. Hopefully we master those energies, and Neptune we find in the seventh house. It's one of the esoteric rulers of veiled by the moon in Virgo. It will be important because it gives us the chance to come together in the light of the intuition. That's what we need, because the new astrology is the intuitional astrology, Master DK tells us. And the intuition is something far more than we may fathom. This is the fifth degree. Fifth degree of Pisces. This is an ancient Chaldean system. Officers on dress parade. Well, I hope we can reveal something of the magnificent order and splendor of the energy configurations in esoteric astrology. The moon and Venus are together, and Venus is the planet with which transmutes the quality of the moon. They are in conjunction. We saw the early morning dew. That is promising. And let's see what we have with this degree of Leo. I think it's one of those rather expressive degrees, as I kind of remember. Sunshine just after a storm. So early morning dew and sunshine just after a storm. I trust we will have some subjective factors working for us, which will bring illumination from behind the scenes. Now, when I work with these Sabian symbols, obviously, they are not the true Chaldean explanation of every degree. That will emerge in time, but they are an approximation by Mark Edmund Jones and a psychic that he worked with almost a century ago in Balboa Park in San Diego. I think it was around 1915 that he did this work. And we have here the, what degree of Scorpio, some degree of Scorpio here. Normally it just pops up, but now I'm having to do it in a somewhat more difficult manner. A massive rocky shore, the fifth degree of Scorpio. Well, it is a formidable continent that we are attempting to explore. I remember when I worked with Charles Jane for just one wonderful year before he passed on. He said, I feel like someone who has discovered a continent, new continent, but will never have the opportunity really to explore it. Well, maybe not in that particular life, but he got many other people started, including some of my colleagues, on some of the inner charts, of which there may be as many as 49 inner charts. And Master Hilarion, he contended, was part of the thought stream which put them on to that type of realization of the inner charts. Maybe that will help us detect something of the chart of the soul. Though when I speak of the chart of the soul, you know, I might have to go back to the time when individualization first occurred for any particular person millions of years ago. And if that occurred on the moon chain, then how in the world would we ever detect it? Still, there will be methods of doing this. And the various planets can represent soul force in the personality chart, and so can the signs of the zodiac themselves. Well, this is a secondary chart, and it has certain potentials for activating a group interest in astrology, I do hope and anticipate. So let's Let's move on to this daunting subject, the science of triangles. Everything is organized in triangles in our cosmos. We have the one, the two, and the three. It's also organized in dualities, and yet it is a profound unity as well. So the triangles represent the three aspects of divinity, out of which the seven come, out of which the 12 come. There are methods of deriving these, and in the derivation of the seven, I think, is of the seven rays, is pretty clear. There are different ways of looking at it, but ray 1, 2, and 3 stand on their own, and ray 4, to me, is a combination of the first and second ray. Some people say the second and third, but I say the first and second because it does have that strong conflict side. Ray 5, the combination of the first and third ray, makes sense because ray 5 souls resolve onto the first ray by and large, and yet the third ray and the fifth ray are so closely related, they both go into great detail, and DK discusses them in Esoteric Psychology number 1, around page 210 or so. A little later than that, and he basically says here that laborious, between the third and fifth rays, this is page 211 actually, between the third and fifth rays there is a close relationship. In the search after knowledge, for example, the most laborious and minute study of detail is the path that will be followed, whether in philosophy, the higher mathematics, see those are third ray things, or in the pursuit of the practical science, and that is the fifth ray. But let us not think that fifth-ray types are not capable of the higher mathematics. They are indeed, and especially when this is combined with the third ray, as it is in the case, I think, of such people as Einstein and Stephen Hawking and many theorists. They probably are essentially third-ray monads, but at least Hawking, you know, has the fifth-ray soul, I think. And Isaac Newton, I think, was a strong blend of the fifth and third rays. He did believe in astrology, by the way, and he did study the subject, as he said, in his rebuke to Sir Edmund Halley, who rebuked him for studying astrology. "Sir, I have studied the subject, you have not," said Newton. Then, you know, when we want to create the sixth ray, I believe it's a combination of the second and the third rays. The two threes or sixes, DK tells us about these numerical relationships. Two ones are two, first and second ray related. Two twos are four, second and fourth ray related. And two threes are six. And there is that idealism found in both of those rays and the tendency to abstraction. As far as the second ray is concerned, the sixth ray resolves onto the second ray or onto the third ray. So both of the rays are connected with six. When we want to create the seventh ray, I believe we have the combination of all, the first, second, and third. It's a balanced blend of all the rays. It is the concrete reflection of the first ray. It is one and seven are closely related, and seventh ray souls resolve onto the first ray principally, although there may be exceptions. When it comes to the second ray, it binds all things together and is a form builder, so the second and seventh are related, the two healing rays. And when it comes to the third ray, these are the two rays of manifestation. So the seventh ray gives more particularized manifestation than the third ray can, but they are both related to planets, which bring things into concrete form, Saturn and Uranus. Anyway, that's my assessment of how the three become the seven, and it's more detailed in Cosmic Fire somewhere about how the seven become the 12. I could probably find that for you. I don't want to go off on a tangent here because I always do. But, you know, let's just, if I can find it quickly, I will. Let's see. It's in my AAB extracts, which I'm happy to share with anybody. There's a lot of them. And let's see. If I do this, 12. The 12 and the 7. Well, Oh, that wasn't too hard, was it? And here you can study this on your own. I'm not going to go into all of this, but the 12 creative hierarchies, students are often puzzled in trying to account for the 12s in Cosmos. A correspondent sent the following suggestions. In a study of consciousness, that's by Annie Besant, the three, by an arrangement of internal groupings, show seven groups, and these may be represented as ABC, ACB, and BCA. BAC, CAB, and CBA. And a seventh, a synthesis in which all three are equal. So I think what they're doing here is arranging these in some sort of order where the first item is the strongest, the second less strong, and the third still less strong. And a seventh item in which all three are equal, which gives me the idea of combining three rays in equal measure to create the seventh ray. So this is, we could probably correlate each of these with one of the rays, a synthesis in which all three are equal, and then a second six would be represented by AB in paren, C, then another C, AB, then ABC, then BC paren A, CA, B, and BAC. The two bracketed being equal and the third stronger or weaker. In this case, I suppose the AB would be stronger than the C. And in the next case, where I have my cursor, the AB would be weaker than the C, and so it goes. The two groups of six and the group in which the three are equal would make 13. The 13 may be arranged in a circle of 12 with one in the center. The central one will be synthetic and will be that class in which all three are equal. The physical correspondence of this will be the 12 signs of the zodiac with the sun in the center, synthesizing all of them. Or maybe, you know, the one about whom not may be said in the center, because the sun is, as a logos, weak when compared to the constellational deities that would be arranged around it. But if they are signs of the zodiac arranged around, then the sun is strong, because the sign of the zodiac is a special adaptation of the constellational energies on a much lower turn of the spiral. The difference between signs and constellations is great, but they have this qualitative attunement. The spiritual correspondence will be the 12 creative orders with the logos at the center synthesizing all. The arrangement is quite legitimate, the Theosophist. And DK did refer to this. This is from Cosmic Fire 1195. So indeed, I did take that tangent. But, you know, we are working here both with rays and with signs of the zodiac and constellations of the zodiac. We're working with 19 energies, and that 19 will become 22 quite easily when we combine the energies of the three great constellations, which are considered to be the Great Bear, Pleiades, and Sirius, although it might be the Little Bear that is a higher correspondence of Sirius. 22 being the mystical, magical number, one of them, and when you think about it, our solar logos has the number 22 particularly effective in this incarnation, this particular solar system, because it has a second ray personality and a second ray soul, 22. We can find the 24 and the 25 if we go on and so forth. So numerology and esoteric astrology do go hand in hand in the great science of relations. How all the many really illusory things coming out of the one are related to each other archetypally according to the design of our universal logos. This is a great mystery, and we are beginning, through the help of the Tibetan master, to lift the veil just a little bit upon our own planetary lore, upon the lore of the planets of our system, upon our solar logos just a little, and his group of seven major constellations in the seven solar systems, of which ours is one, and even lifting just a tiny bit, ever tinier, on the one about whom naught may be said, our local super constellational logos, in which chakras are represented by constellations. It's a vast, vast subject, but DK says when we study it, our horizon will be far, far wider, yet more closely related. And we will begin to see the sense of things, the great intention, the purposeful intention of the beings, plural, in whom we live and move and have our being. But of course, that particular being that is most important to us at the moment is our own planetary logos, who is for us the true one initiator eventually, and toward whom the study of esoteric astrology and all of these various sciences is to lead as we grasp more of the grand design and can apply it in service. The study of esoteric astrology will lead to an understanding of the great group of beings that are involved in our planetary manifestation and beyond, and how all approach towards oneness, which is really the foundation of initiation, will be through group realization. I guess I am following that Mercury retrograde and doing a bit of a retrospective. So we have a chart to begin with. That's our original chart with Leo rising, trying to throw the illumination on this subject. Leo giving us the will to illumine, we know, as well as the will to rule. Lots of light in Leo, because the most luminous of the ray lords is the fifth ray lord, which is associated with Leo. And then Sphinx-like, continuing with Virgo. The Leo-Virgo relationship is the relationship of the Sphinx, the head of the woman and the body of the lion. You can look at it both ways. Virgo seems a little more eminent in this respect, because the head gives us the more human factor, and the lion, the beast in this case. But you can relate these two signs in other ways, which will place Leo in the preeminent position. Well, hopefully we can go deeply here, and we will make our effort. Science of triangles, the greatest of the sciences, the most important science within astrology, beginning on page 404 approximately, and then in the book there's a few pages skipped, because that's often how books are arranged. And so our next actual text is found with its introductory remarks on page 407. And DK tells us that we have been working for some time now upon the third part of our study of the Zodiac of Rays. Well, maybe he considers the first 100 pages or so introductory in that sense. And so then the study of the signs of the Zodiac would be considered the second part. And this would be, to me it's the second part of the book anyway. Anyway, the third part of our study of the Zodiac and the Rays. This entire section deals with the nature of esoteric astrology. And under our introductory remarks, first 100 pages or so, we considered very briefly the significance of esotericism as a whole when applied to modern astrology. So many ideas have to be readjusted. We have to have that willingness to adjust our ideas. Sometimes when we latch onto something and it works, we want to hold it. We want to keep it, because the pain of still acquiring more knowledge and of revising our views and even discarding some types of knowledge which we held dear, well, maybe we don't want to pass through that. But it is necessary, and after a certain time of having done it, one sees the value of it, even though in the beginning the conflict between the old ideas and the new may be a little bit distressing. I've seen many people study esoteric astrology, and yet when they go back to interpret a chart, all of the old ideas of the conventional astrology come to them, and they interpret the chart in terms of conventional ideas. We have to do other than that. We have to interpret the chart in terms of the new ideas which Master DK is presenting to us. So, the significance of esotericism as a whole when applied to modern astrology. We considered the three crosses and referred, again, very briefly, to the relation of the signs to the centers. Well, of course, this is interesting. I guess we did this in passing in various places, but he's going to do this in a concentrated manner, in this section of the book. There will be an entire section on the three crosses and an entire section on the relationship of the astrological factors to the chakric system. We gave most of our time, however, to the analysis of the meaning and interrelation of the 12 signs of the zodiac to each other, to the planets and to the earth, the great science of relations, the science of interrelations, an amazing science where Mercury and on a higher turn of the spiral, Uranus is so important, revealing these patterns, and with the revelation, the light breaks forth. So most of the time was spent in discussing the relationship of the 12 signs of the zodiac to each other, to the planets, and to the earth. We dealt scarcely at all with their effect upon the individual, except in a general sense. Occasionally DK would, you know, as in the last Taurus chapter, talk about how difficult it is for the Taurian individual to deal with that energies of 1 and 5 and even ray 3, which are mediated through the sign or through its close association with Earth. He talked about the best and worst of men being found in Capricorn, and he talked about the difficulty of understanding the sign Libra, the fluidity of Gemini, and so forth, but he didn't really focus on the personal astrology, did he? In passing, we got a little bit of it, and we could apply something, because it's clear that DK has great experience with people in these signs. You can just feel that as he discusses it. But he's choosing to give us a bigger picture, and then we can make the practical application of those indications to the individuals we may seek to assist and to ourselves. Now we begin to take up the third, the third and most important part of the astrological study, entitled The Science of Triangles. So he's dividing it with the introduction, 100 pages, and then another 300 or so pages where he deals with the interrelation of the energies of the signs of the zodiac to each other and to the planets and to the earth, but not to the individual. And now the most important part of this study, the science of triangles. And interesting how the numbers do correlate, isn't it? I mean, in DK's enumeration here, it's the third part, and triangle, of course, is the threefold structure. Even the souls are called triangles. You can see how it would apply very importantly to esoteric astrology, which is essentially the astrology of the soul, or at least the astrology of the soul's influence in the personality chart. We don't really have the astrology of the soul yet. Would that we did, but we have to work our way there carefully. So, the study will fall into three parts, as I earlier indicated, the science of triangles, triangles of energy, constellations. He didn't say signs, but he uses the term signs and constellations interchangeably, and it will take some discernment to discover which he really means at any one point, or whether he means both by indicating one or the other. So that's one of the areas of blinding here that is operating in this book, I think. Triangles of force, which are planetary triplicities. The planets are lords of some rather high development compared to the human being, and yet of relatively small development when compared to great constellational lords. Just think of planetary logos has yet to become a solar logos. I suppose that's one of the paths open to it, a probable path. And solar lords have yet to become constellational lords. So there are two removes here. The planetary lords are two removes from the constellational lords. He hasn't included here the solar lords. He doesn't describe so much the qualities of the fixed stars, except for certain ones like Alcyone and Sirius. And, well, let's see. Polaris is another one. And the realm of the fixed stars becomes particularly important, I think, from the third initiation onward. You know, I say it's not the same thing. If a dog bites you, it may be a Sirian influence, but it's not the full Sirian influence experienced at the third degree. The realm of the fixed stars applies, particularly around the third degree and afterwards, where a man is beginning the solar initiations, right? Up to that time, the two initiations are the threshold of the planetary initiations. And then the triangles and the centers. That'll be the third part, which planetary centers, kingdoms, cities, and human centers, the chakras that we know something about. And we're a great correlational work is underway here. It's very Mercurian, in a sense. And whatever is Mercurian is Uranian in a still higher sense, revealing it all in simultaneity, what Mercury took longer to reveal by making all the links. But DK is so very much Mercurian, if you think of it, just the way perhaps Master KH is more Venusian, or certainly the Christ is. So Buddha and DK are Mercurian, Master KH and the Christ more Venusian, and the two together are indispensable. And Mercury is the great planet of correlation. And so it seems natural enough that Master DK, who has a knowledge of all these many, many correlations, would try to present that to us so that some of us who are on more the Mercurian line, perhaps than the Venusian line, would be able to put this world back together like Isis, you know, after it's all been divided, and see the archetypal patterns emerging here below through the good offices of Mercury. And then suddenly, in a blinding flash, Uranus might come in and reveal the archetype to us without our having to piece it together in a Mercurian manner, Uranus being the higher octave of Mercury, just the way Neptune is the higher octave of Venus. Well, I have analyzed here the point reached in our studies, and I am anxious for you to know, as far as possible, just where we stand in our attempt to throw the light of esoteric understanding upon the present entirely exoteric study of astrology. Well, you know, there was a transitional astrology which emerged. Remember, DK is writing these things about astrology largely in the 1930s. Almost 80 years ago. Yes, and for exactly how many years ago, we could consult with Keith Paley, who I think knows that more exactly, when these books were precisely written. Because they were not written as books, they were written as lesson sets and then later brought together as books. So this is 80 years ago, and then a transitional type of astrology began to emerge. Even in the 1930s, I think that's when Dane Rudyard was writing his Astrology of Personality. And then following in the 50s and the 60s and 70s, 80s especially, 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s especially, the fourth force of astrology, I mean correlating at least with transpersonal psychology, astrology and transpersonal psychology, did emerge. And the astrologers tried to take a deeper view and tried to turn astrology towards that transpersonal center that we in technical occultism call the soul or egoic lotus or higher triad, and a type of astrology which was not specifically esoteric did begin to emerge, but it was not yet the full technical fifth ray esoteric astrology. When I say fifth ray, I mean specificity of the energies concerned, a specific understanding of the energies concerned. It was still vaguer than that. It was not so much Uranian and Mercurian as it was Neptunian, but it did do a lot to reveal how astrology could be understood in relation to that soul center in man. And I think Dane Rudyard, who was a friend of Alice Bailey's and somehow closely related to the later esoteric revelation, though I think he never fully adopted it, he was responsible for this union of transpersonal astrology with transpersonal psychology, the fourth force. Now, there is the fifth force in psychology, and maybe the fifth force in astrology as well, which uses a lot of the fifth ray to be energy specific, as I've tried to say. Energy specificity. Now, DK is presenting that to us, and we do our best to be as specific as possible about the energies available and their possible combinations and what they can yield specifically to the human being in terms of occult development. That occult development being laid out wonderfully in esoteric psychology books and in the rays and the initiations and esoteric healing and so forth. The five-fold treatise on the seven rays. So esoteric astrology book is part of that five-fold treatise, and whatever we learn in it should be applied to all the other four treatises in this treatise on the seven rays. So he wants to tell us where we have arrived, and I would say in the 80 years that we have passed through since he first began to write this, there's been a movement which is a more esoteric movement towards the deeper spiritual aspects of astrology. But compared perhaps to the true esoteric astrology, even those movements seem rather exoteric. In DK's view here, they are entirely exoteric, but I would say there has been some movement towards an esoteric perspective. Before, however, proceeding with our somewhat difficult theme, there are a few words I would like to say in reference to our general attitude and certain things of which I would remind you. Well, we have to be prepared. Our somewhat difficult theme. I realize that to listen to these commentaries, it will take patience and a lot of space on your hard drive. What I have been planning, these, of course, are free of charge, what I'm doing here. But if I can organize DVD sets with all of these commentaries, where there will probably be, 350 or 400 hours of commentary, it may be easier for you to play them and study them rather than to have to download everything. Naturally, there will be materials involved, and there will be some cost involved there. But it may be more convenient. That's not going to be done for a couple of years, I suppose, because all of this has to be, the commentaries, such as I can make them, have to be completed. And then we can think about the best ways of getting them out to you. They're also being uploaded on YouTube, and that's another way of accessing them. But to have them in your possession, I think, is a good thing. And at least it will be a point of departure for your own deeper self-determined study. Study of esoteric astrology. So he's going to do a bit of a review, and he's warning us that we do have a difficult theme here. We have to learn how to think abstractly, which means the bridge of light towards the monastic permanent atom and the abstract mind, the ability to see things in general and in relation to each other in general has to be somewhat developed here. The strictly concrete mind will not be able to follow this. But, you know, this whole treatise on the seven rays is at least for people who are taking or have taken or approaching the first initiation, at least that. And when that happens, the higher mind is coming into play. The egoic lotus is shifting its position to the second subplane of the higher mental plane. And the ability to see patterns, abstract patterns with greater clarity will be emerging.
Right, necessary to get the frog out of here. So he wants to review. And we will go with this review. You know, we can learn how to become master teachers by seeing how Master Kincaid teaches. And think about what he's done, bringing this vast, abstruse, ageless wisdom in some measure to the West, as it originated from the East, making to us and laying the pattern for the Aquarian age. What a great service it was. And, you know, Master Mori and Master K.H. and D.K. were a triangle together, which, as we understand, approached the still higher powers. Word has it around the year 1725, one of the great countries, and asked permission to bring the ageless wisdom closer to humanity. Maybe this is in one of the theosophical sources, I can't pin it down, but I once asked this question of a quite well schooled theosophist, and he said, yes, I think that was found in theosophical works, and it was at the convocation of 1725. Maybe
it was 1825. That was a momentous time when the first Shambhalic impact occurred and when the second ray reached the midway point of its 500-year cycle in terms of the cycles that are related to humanity and the root races. That might have been a good time as well, because it was then, I believe, that shortly after that, that Helena Blavatsky was born. Although they say the masters had been searching for a century to find someone who could be the appropriate amanuensis, and as Blavatsky was born, was it in 1831? Something like that. The century before that would have involved parts of the 18th century. Anyway, the search was on for someone who could carry this information outward to the world. And the three masters concerned did their best for the likes of you and me to bring the great wisdom closer so we could understand the world in a manner not possible to us without such a hierarchical revelation. So our gratitude has to be very great and growing. You know, at first they're just books. You read them and you don't realize what has come along to make them possible, what has been required. The sacrifices of those people involved, the sacrifices of Alice Bailey and her group to make these books available to us. And no doubt the laborious work of Master M, KH, and DK, concentrating on small areas, the upliftment of humanity when they might have been pursuing their own interests, which DK assures us do exist. So we are in the same boat. We are reaching toward the hierarchy and also sometimes toward the spirit, And at the same time, we're doing what we can to reach human beings, the new group of world servers who may not be conscious of the source of so much of the occult wisdom, the men and women of goodwill who are open to such knowledge. And by this means, reaching humanity as a whole, we are trying to do the same, reach in two directions at the same time. Their expanse is greater than ours. The hierarchy reaches higher and reaches lower. And we are simply imitating that process. We reach as high as we can and we reach as low as we can. I think the Buddha and the Christ could talk to anyone. You wouldn't have to be a disciple. You wouldn't have to know the ageless wisdom. They knew exactly what to say to any human being. And sometimes when we get caught up in our subjects with our terminology, we find that it's more difficult to talk to the human being who has not studied these things than it is to talk to someone who has. But no, the Christ and the Buddha could do it. So the hierarchy reaches higher toward Shambhala and still deeper into humanity. Well, they do require our own intimate knowledge of people as they are to carry the subject deeper into the human race. So that's another configuration. We are the ones modifying, qualifying, and adapting the plan. We are the ones who have to reach the man in the street in a certain sense. But they have certainly the ability to know exactly what to say, and we have to learn how to bring our subject down to those who can be reached. Now, what I'd like to do here, maybe you sense I'm stalling just a little bit here, I'd like to say that this is the end of Esoteric Astrology 112A, and we're on page, I think we're just on page 404. No, 407. And I like to end this particular program with the great invocation because it is the great instrument for us. This is the beginning of Esoteric Astrology Adventure, number 112B, page 407. And I would like, you know, the great invocation is so absolutely important, no matter what area of occultism we are investigating, because it is our instrument, best instrument, this invocation for power and light, to bring the hierarchy and the Christ closer to earth in a timely manner. It prepares men's minds and hearts for that great event. It's a twofold event in one, in a way, the externalization of the hierarchy and the reappearance of the Christ. And I'm sure that it will be with us for a long time to come. It's not just a question of dispensing with the great invocation once the Christ has arrived, because it's the Christ consciousness that has to take over the human consciousness. And this Christ consciousness will be growing throughout the Aquarian Age. So even though the great Lord may be walking among us, it's his consciousness which must be returned to human consciousness. May Christ return to earth in the form of an all-pervasive Christ consciousness which can affect at least a good portion of humanity, if not all. So let us together close this first section of the third section of the book with the great invocation. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. I'm reaching here for my pitch pipe. I always like to sound that note on a G, but I oftentimes don't make it and have to consult how far off I was. So, I was one half a step off, one semitone. And sounded an A-flat, which somehow in my constitution, I think it's a Neptunian note, it has resonance with me. But I'll do my best. Home, to use the G, which at present is a second-ray note, although whether we have the true G or not, I don't know.